This may well be the worst committee in the House to give beach balls to, based on the average maturity level of most of our members. But we'll find out. The first bill up is Representative Moe's bill, House File 3356, and the can you actually see me out of those?
See who?
Yeah, that's what I thought. The chair will move House File 3356 to be recommended to pass and refer to the House floor. Representative Moe, welcome aboard.
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Are we going to move this bill, Mr. Chairman? Did you do that already?
Representative Moe, perhaps you couldn't hear through those sunglasses.
No,
it's been moved.
All right, thank you. And it's to the floor, I'm assuming. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to speak briefly on House File 3356, and I have some experts here, which I'm not directly. This gets at the issue of, as you've heard in this committee before, and other committees, that we have some concerns about the challenges for resorts across Minnesota. There's some things, inconsistent winters, real estate pressure, property tax pressure, that are things we've tried to address. Now we have an issue with other cabins being rented out as vacation property and not necessarily having to comply with a lot of the same regulations that resorts are. And so there's some concern whether, so resorters have to comply with Minnesota Department of Health regs, they have to collect lodging tax, they have to do other things that that vacation cabin rentals aren't necessarily having to do. We don't know exactly what the breadth of this problem is. We have a lot of anecdotal evidence, and we'd like to... Are you having a problem taking me seriously, Mr. Chairman, if I have these sunglasses on?
I never have a problem taking you seriously, Representative. It makes no difference to me whether you have those sunglasses or not.
Mr. Chairman, your trail is in the bill. I like Jim gets it.
All in favor?
No.
And so we've asked, and then what this bill does is ask Explore Minnesota Tourism to look at this issue. They've said that they were planning on looking at it anyway, doing a study, and so they believe that this won't cost them anything. We have a fiscal note of zero, so they're going to study this problem and report back to the legislature. You know, how broad is this problem? Are there any legislative solutions that can... We don't want to keep these people from renting cabins up north. We want to make sure as many people come up as possible, but we also want to make sure that we're collecting the taxes, appropriate taxes, and that these properties are being inspected and have all the safeguards necessary to create an even marketplace, and also to make sure that that people who are renting them are getting a safe, clean place and not being brought through the ringer in some other way. So with that, I'm going to bring up our experts, and Joel has his sunglasses on too. Perhaps he needs somebody to walk him down or a cane.
Oh, I got it.
Yeah, all right. Go ahead, Joel Carlson, Minnesota Resort Owners. Yeah. Oh, we have some resorters here too that are going to talk.
Couple.
Okay, good. Is Kevin talking? Yeah.
Go ahead, Dave.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul. And since 1997, I've had the pleasure of representing the Congress of Minnesota Resort. That is the small resort organization in Minnesota. You may refer to them as Mom and Pa Resorts. These are small business owners in Minnesota, and we come to the Capitol each year with issues that affect us. We got issues. And
yes, we know.
Especially later on today.
And Mr. Chairman, members, this is a serious issue that we would like the legislature to look at, and it isn't conduct that we hope to control or restrict, but we want to make sure that it's safe for consumers, that it's a level playing field for the lodging community, and that it's done with legislative knowledge and foresight, so that we know that if there is a tax implication from rental property, it should be imposed. If there isn't, we don't want everybody that rents out their cabin once a summer to be subject to regulation, but we do know that there are a number of properties that are in the nightly, weekly, and monthly rental business, similar to resorts and other lodging establishments, and Minnesota does not have a response to that. We hope that EMT will guide us through a study of that and recommend to you any possible legislation that will address this issue. We also care about the school calendar and post-Labor Day school and Game and Fish, and we have other issues, but this is one that is emerging for us, and we appreciate the committee taking their time and attention in addressing it, and hopefully next session we'll have a report to you on where this issue needs to go in the future. I have with me Dana Pitt, who is the president of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, and I know he'd like to just add his thanks to the committee for taking their time and attention on this, and Kevin Matzik from Hospitality Minnesota is also here, and I think he'd like to at least wave the flag to let you know that this isn't an issue that is across all of the lodging industry. It's not just small resorts that are impacted by this. So with that,
thank you, Mr. Carlson. They made it a rule that if you wanted to testify, you had to put the shades down.
As Joel said, my name is Dana Pitt. I own Bailey's Resort on Leaf Lake in Walker, and I am president of Congress of Minnesota Resorts. I just briefly wanted to say that the Congress does very much support this bill on vacation. Home rental is an issue for us. We don't know how big an issue it is right now. We're just hoping that this study by Explore Minnesota will, you know, get a handle around it, and we'll be able to make better decisions on how to handle this in the future. We just want to thank you for your support on this issue.
Thank you. I was looking up there for you, Mr. Matz. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Kevin Matzik. I work for Hospitality Minnesota, and today I'm here representing the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association, as well as the Minnesota Lodging Association. Over 450 resorts and 500 hotels, motels throughout the state. And over the past year, the issue of private homes being rented out as vacation destinations has really emerged as really the number one issue facing resorts in Minnesota. It's an emerging issue. Just today I was on a website, VRBO.com. There was over 400 properties listed on their individual homes that are available for rent. So it's an emerging market, and so we really just want to reiterate what was said earlier and thank Representative Moe for bringing this forward. That we do need to look at this issue and study it and see what the issues are moving forward. We've actually had a couple of meetings in our office with Department of Revenue, Department of Health, the private cabin owners, the Planning and Zoning Association, just to start discussing amongst ourselves what the issues are. And so, you know, we support this legislation moving forward and having Explore Minnesota Tourism look at it. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Matzik. Is there anyone else that desires to testify with respect to this bill? Are there questions or concerns from members of the committee? Representative Burns?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope that one of the things that the study looks at is, of course, taxes and regulation. When I say that, I mean reducing that on the Congress and your members and other small resort owners, rather than just adding more taxes and regulation to another part of the economy to make it even. I certainly feel for small, especially family-owned resorts, you've been operating for generations sometimes. I want to make sure that we do our part to make sure the economy looks out for you, the little guy. So I hope that will definitely be part of the study. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Burns. Anybody else? Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess just a couple of comments.
By the way, didn't you guys track whenever you want to say something, you have to...
I'm really trying hard to get used to bifocals. I don't know if I'm ready for the dark shades or not. I've had the pleasure of working with the tourism the last number of years, and I think that I think there's a lot of merit in what you're trying to do with this bill, and we need to study this. I do think we need to find out what is really happening out there. I do have some concerns in that being that with the amount of resorts that we have lost throughout the state, this may be a new trend, and this may be a new form of ability for people to be able to use our lakes. So I think that doing this has a benefit, and it has a good benefit to find out just what is happening, how many of these are being done, and if they are, then should there be compensation to make it a fair playing field, and I think that's all the resorters are asking for, and I think they should have that right to do so. So I appreciate the fact that this is being looked at. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Simpson. Is there anybody else on the committee that has any questions or concerns? All right, if not, and I did promise them a quick photo after we pass the bill, if the bill passes, but I think, speaking for everybody on the committee, we are, you know, this is Minnesota way of life, gentlemen, and we appreciate the proposal that you're making. We're happy to be a committee that has a little something to do with tourism, and we're happy to try to help. So if that means dealing with beach balls and so forth, we're happy to do that as well. Although you guys promised me you'd have zinc oxide on your noses, and I don't see any zinc on people's noses.
Mr.
Carlson.
We made a good faith effort to we were unable to do that, and I apologize for you, but we appreciate the committee.
If your sense of humor was only as good as your bill, with that,
my office,
all in favor say aye.
Aye.
That motion carries. That was House File 3356. That moves to the floor. With that, we are going to take a 1-minute recess, and we literally are. We're going to put these suckers on. This is for resorters, right? If you don't want to, then don't do it. But gosh darn it, any of you folks, come on down here. You got to wear them too. If we're going to put them on, we want to see all the resorters down here in the middle.
I can just see the next campaign brochure.
This will be in my opponent's flyer. even Simpson put them on. Bifocals or not. God bless you, Dino.
Hey, Bern, right?
What are we doing?
We're walking in.
Jerry, you got to put your sunglasses on.
Darn right.
Up, then you got to close your eyes. Oops. Okay, sorry.
You're
going
to have to sit down or something.
I'd offer to help find a pair of sunglasses, but I can't. So.
We're just doing this for gold,
yeah. Oh.
Hey. You only pick on the ones you love. Throw the balls in. Here they come. 1, 2, 3. All right. Thank you all very much for coming down. Good luck.
Yeah, that's what I wanted.
Got
All right. We'll call the meeting back to order. Next item up is House File 3212. This is Representative Johnson's bill. Representative Johnson moved House File 3212. And it's my understanding, Representative Johnson, I got a note that the university folks, everybody's agreed that they could testify first, if that's all right with you. Hey, Representative Johnson, I will turn it over to you to kind of walk through your bill for us briefly, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to make a few initial comments, then talk about the purpose of the bill, and go from there. I also have a couple of testifiers, some university alumni, one from University of Minnesota, one from University of Wisconsin, who's now a big Gopher fan. They both want to get a chance to say a few words as well. Now, the Big Ten Network is the only place Minnesotans can watch sporting events where the U of M competes. You can catch some of the activity on ESPN or some of the regular networks, but as far as practical being able to watch them on a regular basis, BTN, the Big Ten Network, is the only game in town. And it's not just the big money sports that you see on the Big Ten Network. You can also catch such as men's football and basketball. But you can also catch the gymnastics and track and field, wrestling, volleyball, hockey, and so forth. And the great thing about the Gophers, and we kind of witnessed this during the stadium debate with the Vikings versus the stadium debate with the Gophers. With the stadium debate with the Vikings, it was so divisive and full of acrimony. Contrast that with the discussion we had about the Gophers, where it was much less so and much more congenial and much easier to get through. And I think it's largely because of our relationship and our personal associations with the University of Minnesota as being our hometown folks and our team. Now, the Big Ten Network is airing the games, but unless you have satellite, you're out of luck and you're not going to see it. Folks with Comcast Cable, the area's largest distributor, are left out of the game, and for the Twin Cities areas, that's over a half million households. That's a lot of folks who aren't able to catch these games. So the purpose of this bill, quite simply, is to create a mechanism for cable operators such as Comcast or Charter, and video providers such as the Big Ten Network, to pursue arbitration and resolve the standoff. Now, this is an issue I hear about regularly when I'm at the gas station or at the hardware store or whatever from neighbors and friends. They're frustrated by the standoff between these two big players, between the Big Ten Network and the cable companies. And what folks want to see is our Gophers playing, and that's essentially what the intent of this bill is. Provide a mechanism, provide an opportunity for these folks to sit down, work out the problem, and get the games back on television so our state can follow them. And that, in essence, is the purpose of the bill. I can walk through the specifics, but I just can turn over testimony, I believe.
Fair enough. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I know that the university folks, Mr. Iverson, I don't know who you all have testifying, but if you want to just send folks down, we'd be happy to welcome their comments and welcome certain folks back to the House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been a long time. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Liz Yule. I'm the Senior Associate Athletics Director and Chief Financial Officer for Gopher Athletics at the University of Minnesota. My understanding is that the committee is interested in having a better understanding of the relationship between the University of Minnesota and the Big Ten Network. Before I begin, I should say that I'm not providing testimony today for or against the bill that's in front of you. The University of Minnesota does not have a position on this bill. First of all, I guess I'd like to say that the relationship between the Big Ten Network and the University of Minnesota works basically this way. 11 schools in the Big Ten Conference. We've all assigned our TV rights over to the conference. The conference then negotiates television contracts on our behalf, all of our schools' behalf, to basically achieve the best deal that they can, the best agreements that they can. The end result of those efforts is that we have agreements with ABC, CBS, ESPN, and we have the creation of the Big Ten Network, which is in partnership with Fox Sports. The university believes that this is a smart decision to enter into this agreement to create the Big Ten Network for for basically three main reasons. The first one is exposure. With the Big Ten Network, there's a tremendous amount of additional television exposure for our 25 teams and the student athletes that wear the M. The total number of Gopher events on television is greater this year than ever before. We're up about 30% from where we were last year. Great example of this increased television exposure is three Big Ten championships that we hosted are hosting this year. We hosted women's soccer in the fall, and that was on the Big Ten Network on television really for the first time. This coming weekend, we'll be hosting the women's indoor track Big Ten championship, and the following weekend, we'll be hosting wrestling. Again, the Big Ten championship for wrestling. Great exposure for our student athletes who will work so hard and represent our school and our state so well. Secondly, we're able to maintain better control of our scheduling when it comes to our events on the Big Ten Network. And finally, the money. The Big Ten Network is providing to the 11 schools in the Big Ten a new source of revenue for us. For Minnesota, it means that we can provide the financial resources that our 25 teams need to win championships, provide funding to support the cost of 322 full scholarships for our student-athletes' academic pursuits, helps us provide funds to maintain our many athletic facilities, and it also provides funds to further our goal to be more financially self-sufficient. Finally, Mr. Chairman, I understand that there are meaningful negotiations occurring currently between the Big Ten Network and the major cable providers. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for having me here today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Yule. And I alluded earlier to Ms. Yule as an alumni of the House, and we welcome you back. I'm an alumni of the University of Minnesota as well. So we
kind
of have. But thank you very much for your comments, and I think what we're going to do, we'll take as much testimony as we can, and then if there's questions from the committee, we'll go there.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks again. I've got a couple other folks that called ahead and wanted to be on the list. I would also call your attention to there's a statement from the Big Ten Network who we visited with in your packet, and there is also, a letter from President Brunix as well. But I've got a couple folks from Comcast, either Mr. Berkelman or Mr. Coleman, if they're around and desire to testify. I don't see them running on down there. Oh, there's. And then I see also a couple of fellows that are all adorned in University of Minnesota stuff, so I suspect they might want to say a few words as well, right, gentlemen? Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please grab it. There's a couple chairs nearby. We want you to make yourselves comfortable as well.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'm Mike Martin. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Cable Association, a trade group of cable companies in Minnesota. I'm here today with our association legal counsel, Tony Mendoza, and also I have with me Ms. Tara Corvo, an attorney from Washington who's represented the cable industry on this issue in other jurisdictions, so they'll both have comments in a minute. This matter is very important to us. It does impact a number of cable companies in Minnesota. However, because of ongoing negotiations, the companies themselves are unable to participate in any public comments. And as you heard from the previous speakers, there are meaningful negotiations underway. We would, however, like to comment on the bill and respond to some of the comments that are being made. First, let me say that while this issue may seem to address whether or not the Big Ten Network is carried, there are other networks that would take advantage of this if they could. It certainly would have impacted the Victory Sports Channel that was launched by the Twins in 2004. You'll recall that the Twins wanted to move baseball games away from free broadcasts and put them on a new channel available only on cable and satellite. So the impact is not just limited to the Big Ten Network, nor is it just limited to sports programming. Secondly, regulations for the carriage of programming are very complicated. They represent efforts by Congress and the FCC to maintain a competitive video marketplace to protect the signals of local broadcast stations and network affiliates. And since the Cable Act of 1992, they prevent cable companies from withholding access to programming they own from satellite companies and Dish and DirecTV and other competitors. We would maintain that the federal preemption in this issue is very clear, and the attorneys here will discuss that in more detail. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, and at this time I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Corbeau, who can discuss this.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Folks, one thing, I don't mean to pick on you in particular, but we've got a rather full agenda, so if we can, and the understanding that I have, in light of the fact that the author's understanding is now that there has been, or there are some meaningful negotiations taking place, the intent is to lay this bill over. So with that in mind, if you can capitalize your comments rather briefly, we'd appreciate it. Welcome. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you. As Mr. Martin said, my name is Tara Corbeau. I'm here for the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. I'm really here today with just two simple points. First, the Minnesota legislature, like all state legislatures, are preempted from legislating in this field because program carriage disputes are already specifically and comprehensively addressed in the Federal Cable Act and have been since 92. Section 616 of the Act covers exactly the kind of issue of dispute that this bill would cover today. If an independent programmer doesn't get carriage from a cable operator because the programmer believes the video programmer has discriminated against it, the Federal Cable Act provides a mechanism for the FCC to hear that complaint and to adjudicate whether or not failure to reach a carriage agreement is the result of some unlawful motive. Section 624 of the Act prohibits states from imposing requirements regarding the provision or content of cable service unless expressly allowed by the Act. The Federal Cable Act includes no express authorization for state involvement in carriage disputes. And finally, Section 636 of the Act says that any state law that is inconsistent with any provision of the Federal Cable Act is preempted. House File 3212 is inconsistent with federal law in at least three ways. First, under the federal scheme, a programmer alleging some discriminatory motive has to show some discrimination and competitive harm in order to get relief. House File 3212 would allow a programmer to demand arbitration only if it has reason to believe that it has been treated unfairly. Federal law would require the FCC, rather than an arbitrator, to hear that carriage complaint. And under federal law, all terms and conditions of carriage would be subject to review, while under House File 3212, the arbitrator would be compelled to accept the terms and conditions of carriage proposed by the programmer. While characterized as an arbitration bill, the measure as a practical matter mandates carriage of every sports, entertainment, and news programming service on the tier of service requested by the programmer, with arbitration limited only to the cash price that the operator must pay. Not only is House File 3212 preempted by the Federal Cable Act, but it raises serious constitutional concerns because it is not content neutral. It gives arbitration rights only to providers of particular kinds of programming, sports, news, entertainment. The First Amendment has looked very unkindly on legislatures that favors particular kinds of content over others. And it's worth noting that this bill is not limited to disputes over sports programming. If you enact House File 3212, you open a Pandora's box to demand for mandatory carriage by many other programming services, subjecting private negotiations to government-driven rules. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm happy to answer any questions now or at the end.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming today. Mr. Mendoza, you've been looking very lawyerly there for a while. Can I add anything?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Anthony Mendoza. I'm outside counsel to the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. And I have very little to add. I know your time is short, so I'll just keep my comments fairly brief. I did want to add one comment about some of the jurisdictional issues that are presented that would also present obstacles to this bill. House File 3212 would allow a programmer such as the Big Ten Network or the NFL Network to bypass the FCC, which has been designated by Congress as the expert arbiter of programming disputes, and place those decisions within the Minnesota Department of Commerce. The Department of Commerce has no expertise regulating video services, and much less arbitrating programming disputes. There is really no state agency or Minnesota political subdivision that has the regulatory expertise to handle such disputes, and under the legal doctrine of primary jurisdiction, I think this bill would also run into serious challenges. I'm going to skip over a lot of some of what I had here in the interest of time. I just wanted to also add that in addition to the federal First Amendment problems that the bill has, House File 3212 would also run into Minnesota constitutional challenges under Article 1, Section 3 that guarantees the right of free speech in the state of Minnesota. That jurisprudence in Minnesota generally follows the contours of the federal First Amendment cases. The Cable Act also had has a very deliberate regulatory dualism that gave local franchising authorities responsibility for franchising and for essentially regulation of the use of the public rights of way. The FCC clearly, under federal law, retained exclusive oversight of signal carriage. The law could not be more clear on this point. State and local franchising authorities have no jurisdiction over authority for signal carriage. Under this bill, state government would be instituting a rate regulation regime that is designed to increase programming costs, and as a result, the rate the customers pay for cable television service. The Minnesota Cable Communications Association urges the committee to reconsider this legislation and to let the players battle this one out on the field. Thank you for your testimony, or thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Mendoza. I sometimes thank myself for my own comments. I appreciate you being here with us. With that, is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to this item? So, Representative Johnson, in sum, you're, other than defying the state constitution, the federal constitution, the FCC, probably a whole bunch of other acronyms, but at least we've got the Gopher fans here. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee. The only rule we have is you just identify who you are and you proceed with the testimony.
Mr. Chair, Dave Cosciola, sports fan of the Big Ten. We did not bring any legal counsel.
Well, you can't have everything.
I can shorten my part up really quick. I am a sports fan of the Big Ten. I'm representing the schizophrenics in Minnesota because I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Now I'm a loyal fan of the Gophers because I've returned.
All right, you can keep talking then.
I'm a season ticket holder for the women's basketball program, have been for several years. All I ask is that I get to see the games that I don't get to see when they're at home. And when I hear meaningful negotiation, it's been going on how long, how much longer. So I'd like to see it resolved so I can see the game.
Thank All right. You. Thank you. Appreciate you taking the time to come out here and talk to us. Yes, sir.
My name is Pete Swenson, also a citizen of the state of Minnesota, alumni of the University of Minnesota. I'm aligned with Mr. Kosciolek on this one. I think that these people have been talking for a long time. They both think they have the upper hand, and for whatever reason, they say they're negotiating, but there's no progress. I just think it's unacceptable since most of the value created in the sports comes either directly or indirectly from the state of Minnesota or alumni donors, that that we are prevented from being able to see most of the games. In fact, I don't think there's been one women's basketball game on television all year this year. That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Swenson. Thank you, Mr. Castellola. Is there anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to this item? Otherwise, we'll take some questions from members of the committee. Again, gentlemen, thank you very much. Is there questions or concerns from members of the committee? Representative LaForest.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Johnson, thanks for bringing your bill forward. I think we know why it's here, although it's going to get laid over and you tweaked. You ran afoul of just a couple of laws there. But we've all heard from constituents who are growing frustrated with the foot-dragging regarding negotiations with respect to this issue. I mean, it's been through football season. Maybe it's good that we didn't see some of those games, although I listen to them on the radio. Basketball season, we're into hockey season, and on it goes. And there's a public component to all of this because the taxpayers of Minnesota, as the witnesses just indicated, provide a good amount of funding for the university to include athletic facilities and athletic scholarships. So there is a public interest involved in that. So I think it's time for the parties to get moving on this, or perhaps more and more legislation will be forthcoming. I don't know, but it is time to resolve this in the public interest. More than that, I think there's a great deal of concern about the quality of programming with the Big Ten Network itself. I may be starting to editorialize a little bit, but even the North Dakota hockey fan, am I right, starting to have some empathy here. You know, last Friday, the Gophers faced off against Wisconsin here in the border battle, and the men's hockey program is one of the few revenue-positive programs at the University of Minnesota, and they cut in the second period for a press conference for Indiana basketball. And if that's going to be the kind of quality programming we're going to get out of the Big Ten Network, I think it's not going to be such a cash cow as you had indicated it might be. So, Representative Johnson, thanks once again. I really appreciate what you're doing. Well, this may not be exactly the right vehicle, but I would say they got to go to court anyway if they think it's unconstitutional. So maybe you ought to run forward with it.
Are there any other comments or questions from members of the committee? Representative Johnson, any final comments that you'd like to make with respect to the bill?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for the time and for the committee's patience, and I look forward to this issue getting resolved.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I think I speak for just probably about everybody in the room, other than perhaps the Big Ten Network or Comcast necessarily. We just want to watch sports on TV, folks, and we've gotten to the fourth quarter. We're going to let the players try to solve it on the field, but if you don't, it's about time the umpires step in. So the chair's going to lay this bill over. Representative Johnson, we appreciate you bringing it forward. And I guarantee the parties, and please take this message back, that this bill will come back again if, in fact, those negotiations are not meaningful like they've been described and some progress isn't made. This may not be the perfect instrument, but we'll figure out some way to impact it. And hopefully we'll just see success. We're tired of missing football and basketball games, and we'll get her done. Representative Mahoney.
Could you tell me how much time is left for legislative session?
Plenty.
Oh, I... Time is getting short, is what I would
well,
say.
Well, we'll hopefully see the meaningful negotiations pay off, Representative Mahoney, in short order. And if they don't, we'll figure out an instrument to make sure it moves. Representative Johnson, thanks again. Before we get to the next bill, Representative Hilton, if you'd be kind enough to come down, but I do want to take Representative Anderson. I know you've had a chance to review all of the minutes. Representative Anderson moves the minutes of the last meeting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Hilstrom, the chair will move House File 2964 regarding simulcasting at the harness track. In that, as I understand it, is recommended to pass move to the House floor. There is an author's amendment.
There is, Mr. Chair. The author's amendment is the 081127, and it is changing the effective date, and the reason is because it didn't become law last year.
Fair enough. The chair will move the 081127 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Representative Hilstrom, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2964 is a simulcasting for horse racing, the harness track. You all heard this bill last year. And I'd just like to turn it over to my witness and let you get back to your business, Mr. Chair.
That's my kind of presentation, Representative Hilstrom. You're welcome to come back anytime.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Welcome to the committee. I thought you were putting sunglasses on there for a second.
No.
Maybe you saw what we did earlier. But
Chairman Atkins, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here. As a U of M graduate, law school, et cetera, I feel like I'm right at home with all the prior activity. I understand that our time is limited, Mr. Chair, and I would like to spend just a moment introducing a couple of people who will be here to answer questions and have been terrific for us. First of all, Milton County Commissioner Dan Earhart. Dan, I wanted to recognize you. And Mayor Mel Mettler. Mayor Mettler of the City of Columbus. With that, we'll move quickly. We do have one of the harness folks who'd like to talk after me, if that would work, Chairman. My name is Jeff Halpern, and I am one of the founders of Southwest Casino, which in turn is one of the founders of the new track, the North Metro Harness Initiative, running Aces Harness Park. It's a pleasure to be here. This has been a five-year effort. I think some of you have probably followed us. We have gone through all the trials and tribulations, every approval, the Racing Commission, City of Columbus, County, You name it, we've gone through it, and we're so pleased to be here today. Our facility in Columbus, and by the way, for those of you that don't know, the 35 E&W come together and become 35 going north. The first exit is the 9723 exit. We're right on the west side of the freeway, a wonderful location. That's where we are, right in the city of Columbus. And it is a $62 million privately funded facility. The folks on the southwest side are Minnesota folks. My two partners and MTR are a wonderful partner from the east that's helped us through this entire process. We open on the 11th of April, and all of you are cordially invited. We'll make that formal at a later time, but this is going to be a very fun venue. It's going to be family-oriented. It's going to be a county fair-type environment, and it's going to be simply terrific. The impact, if I can just summarize it quickly, is substantial. This will generate in excess of 600 full-time job equivalents. We'll have a payroll in excess of $10.5 million. I might add that we had a job fair this past Saturday. We had over 1,000 applicants from the area and elsewhere, 1,000 folks that came out to apply for jobs at this facility with a lot of excitement, and we were so happy to have them. The vicinity will be paying significant taxes, real estate taxes in excess of $800,000, $227,000 of which has been earmarked for the city of Columbus, so they'll get their share. In addition to that, we'll be committing an additional $90,000 for public safety services and the like, so we will not burden traffic, ingress, egress, etc. We're moving the park and ride onto our parking lot. We added a light, fire safety, etc. Again, the city was very concerned about traffic, about noise, environmental. Well, we went through all of it. As I said, we got no soft blows on this. We really, truly went through about every regulatory authority that was possible. This will also have tremendous agri and equine impact. On the horse side of things, there will be offshoot facilities, goods and services, I want to make the point, too, that our company has always been a good corporate citizen, I think better than a good corporate citizen. Everywhere we've been, we have contributed back to the community. This is a privately funded venture, and we will be doing what we need to do, and happily for the city and for the county and for the state. Our first event, just to give you some idea, we have the Youth Service Bureau on April 4th before we open, one of our first three charitable activities that we'll be sponsoring at that facility for charities. One important thing here is that finally the harness folks and the harness aficionados will finally have a home after the great Dan Patch tradition that's prevailed in our state. The harness folks really have been kind of forgotten citizens. They've had a few weeks here, a few weeks there, county fairs and the like. They're going to have a wonderful state-of-the-art facility in the city of Columbus. And we hope and believe that we will be for the harness breed what Canterbury has been for the thoroughbreds. We believe that we will grow that industry and have a wonderful, wonderful experience in the state of Minnesota. I personally made over 220 calls to Canada and to the seven-state area talking to harness people. Incredible responses. The worst response I got was an 83-year-old who said he had just retired his harness horse, but he'd be there cheering. So this is truly going to be the mecca for harness racing, and will have tremendous impact on the area and jobs and the generation of values and so on in the city of Columbus. It should be noted that there has always been all-breed simulcast. And this is not a new phenomenon that that's the subject of this bill. Canterbury has had it all along, and now that we've got harness up there, and they'll continue with thoroughbreds, obviously, we need to have the bill to envelop what's already always been the case in Minnesota, namely having all breeds. We know of no other track in the country that does not, that simulcast, that does not have all breed simulcast. This is not a product pursued by other gaming interests or other entities. This is a product that goes hand in hand with harness racing. It is a necessary component. We want somebody from up north, if they want to come to our facility on the Derby day and make a $2 wager on the Derby without having to think about should I travel 50 miles or maybe I wouldn't at all, this is what it's all about. We have had a truly cooperative effort here. We've had the HBPA. We've had all the horse interests. We've cooperated. We've got arrangements with them that are fair and equitable. They are all supportive of our bill, and we believe that the bill will be an important component of our future, which we think is extremely bright. And as I said, we will be good citizens and make contributions to the state, to Agra, Equine, et cetera. And Chairman Atkins, I appreciate greatly the opportunity after these years being here in front of the committee. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Helfern. We appreciate having you.
Thank you so much. Sir, if I might introduce Greg Budak in behalf of the harness folks. I think we need to hear from our horsemen. This is what this is all about. Greg, come on in, please.
We will be brief, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Greg Budak. I'm the Secretary Treasurer of Minnesota Harness Racing, Inc. Been in that role for probably 12 years. Just want to speak briefly to the impact of this bill on us. I personally have written the checks for the purses that we've paid out of this simulcast revenue that, if you do not act on it, will end at Canterbury as well this year. So it affects not only our track, but also Canterbury Park. They can no longer simulcast harness once we start racing live at North Metro at Running Aces. So to that, I've paid out average close to nearly $200,000 a year for the last 12 years to Minnesota horses and horsemen, horse people racing in Minnesota. So that without that money coming in through simulcast, that will greatly impact us. All that money is paid out through fair racing at county fairs in Minnesota. So we are fully behind this, and we want to see all breed simulcasting at not only our new track, but also at Canterbury to continue so that we can continue to fund our program in Minnesota and help the horse racing industry, especially Minnesota horses, grow in the state. We restrict most of our fair racing to Minnesota-owned or bred horses, so with that, most of the money is staying right here in the state. So anything that you could do to expedite this would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, Mr. Chair, we'll stand for those.
Very good. Why don't we see, is there any other testimony before we go back to members of the committee? Is there anyone else that desires to testify with respect to this bill? Yes, sir. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be here to answer questions if necessary as well. Thank you.
Very good. Now, I think you guys have been through this before. If you can just identify who you are, proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. My name is Don Sankey. And the rest of the committee also. I've been a resident of Columbus for 57 years and am extremely concerned about the future of our community. I've come before you today representing the Columbus Concerned Citizens, a 501c4 corporation. We have been at the Capitol opposing this language or similar language that's contained in House File 2964 since 2003. You may have heard that the opposition to the track in Columbus is now gone and that it has been replaced by overwhelming support. Sometimes saying something doesn't make it so. In fact, opposition to this project remains strong. House File 2964 asks you to approve all breed simulcasting for Running Aces. Our community has been told over and over that this facility is a family-friendly venture that is all about helping the horse industry and agriculture in Minnesota. If this is so, then why do the owners want to start racing on April 11th and quit for the season on July 6th? If the need to get the card room open is their main concern, what about the horses? What happened to the rest of the summer? This legislation proposes to put millions of dollars in the pockets of the developers while doing very little for the industry they say they built to support. You have been told there is an agreement between Canterbury and Running Aces to share all the all-breed simulcasting revenue. Last Wednesday, we heard that there actually was such an agreement. Have you seen any signed, executed contracts? The Running Aces owners have come to many different government bodies with all kinds of alleged agreements, but the agreements are never signed and or are changed many times before and if they are executed. According to the Star Tribune in an October 13, 2007 article, Canterbury took in $59 million on all simulcasting, but only $3 million came from harness racing simulcasting. If Canterbury wants to give away $56 million, then let's see what kind of a deal they have worked out. Canterbury has come before you in the past asking for the expansion of card tables so they can increase their revenue, but are now willing to give up revenue to a new competitor. There is a cry that we must be fair about simulcasting. You just heard that a little bit ago. After all, if Canterbury can simulcast harness racing, then why can't Running Aces simulcast all breeds? Again, if this is such an important issue now, then why not get the law changed before the facility is built? After all, they have known for 5 years that all breeds simulcasting was not allowed. If it was not fair the last 5 years, why is it suddenly fair today? They have repeatedly told the community that this is a viable business as it was originally proposed. So what is the real reason for this legislative change? Perhaps this is it. This business venture was financed by a $41.7 million line of credit with a floating interest rate starting at over 12%, which has now come down to a little less than 10%. The loan has a final balloon payment due on April 20th, 2014, less than 6 years from the running of the first race. This is likely the reason for the legislative change, not to help the horse racing industry in Minnesota. We fail to see any reason to expand gambling in Minnesota. The owners of Running Aces have known since before they started this venture what the law was. They have tried unsuccessfully every year since 2003 to change the law. No one forced them to build this facility with outrageous financing. Why should you bail them out with a law change when they had no business starting to build before they had all the tools in place to help them be successful? This seems to be putting the cart before the horse. Running Aces representative, Mr. Helfren, who you just heard from, came before the September 20th, 2007 meeting of the Minnesota Racing Commission, and when asked specifically by Commissioner Overton what will happen if this legislation does not pass, replied that this is a multi-million dollar item for them, but would not be a death blow if they did not receive the financing. Running Aces management has stated at the Minnesota Racing Commission and again last Wednesday in the Senate State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Subcommittee on Gaming that this legislation is not needed for their financial success. So let them make them abide by their word. Just because Running Aces agreed to drop their request for a waiver of 50 days of live racing before they could open their card room, don't give them all breed simulcasting as a reward for this. After all, isn't this supposed to be a horse racing track? Why pass this bill and allow the opening of the floodgates of gambling expansion in Minnesota? We understand there are other legislatures with gambling bills already to be introduced in this session. There is no way that it can be argued that this is anything but an expansion of gambling. We are asking you to defeat House File 2964, just as we have done for the last 5 years, and stop the expansion of gambling in Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Stanky. Appreciate your comments. It's my understanding that I want to take, if there's any other testimony, I want to take that, but I understand from Mr. McCormick he does have a small technical amendment. But before we do that, is there any other testimony at this time? Okay, before we go to questions, Mr. McCormick, what's the suggested technical change?
Mr. Chairman, we'd just be correcting a citation. On page 3, line 33, the correct citation should read, in section 240.06, subdivision 5. So we would be deleting paragraph B.
Okay. The chair will move that to
subdivision 5B and then delete paragraph C. We would leave 5B alone.
All members clear on what that does? Okay, the chair will move that to put it in the shape that we need to proceed with it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion is adopted. With that, Representative Hillstrom, I should ask, are there questions, concerns from members of the committee? I think we had Representative Dabney had a question that he asked.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for, is it Mr. Helfren from the track? Mr. Helfren, I was intrigued by the comments from the gentleman from the township that you're planning on closing racing the first weekend in July, something like that.
And I'm wondering if you could speak to the length of your season. You can call me Representative Johnson if you want. If you want to comment on the length of the season, contrast that with Canterbury, who I see you're buying the simulcast from. Talk about the rationale for your season length. Please.
Mr. Helfern, thank you. The Representative Dabney's question.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney. With respect to Canterbury's season, Canterbury is running around 56 days as their season. We'll have an initial season of 53 days. I am not denying the fact that the cardroom that is part and parcel of this thing is the engine to enhance purses. That's what saved Canterbury and permitted it to go forward. It will also be the thing that will help drive purses and attract and retain horses in Minnesota. We are starting earlier this year and will end earlier to get in our 50 days, which under Minnesota law is required before you open the card room. I can assure you that in the future we will have a more traditional May through August type schedule that will be worked out with the Racing Commission in the ordinary course, and our 53 days will be something there or in excess and will be held at more traditional times starting later in the year. This year was a necessity. We're done. We'll be open on the 11th, and we need to get those 50 days in. And that's why, sir, that we are running on an April 11th till July 5th, 4th initial season. Thereafter, it will be, as I say, a May through August season.
Representative Dammey, follow up for you. Good for now.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just thinking back to Representative Murphy M. comments on the floor once about how when horse racing was legalized in the state, the industry came forward and said, we're going to be successful as horse race tracks, and we're going to support agriculture in Minnesota, we're going to support the horse industry. And I can't do as well as she did. But her main point, as I recall, was every year or two, the horse racing industry is back looking for an exception, an addition, an expansion, and it seems in this case the tail is wagging the horse. And instead of a horse racing track offering a card room, we've got a card room offering a horse racing track. And particularly this year with the limited number of days. And it just seems, I said it on the floor once, I think it's time that the horse racing industry stood on its own 4 feet. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I commend Representative Hillstrom on a bill. This has bill has seen a very long and winding road, and I commend you. I think it's come a long way from the original spot, and I will be not only as a co-author but be supporting the bill today. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Are there other comments or questions for the author, for Representative Lilly?
Mr. Chair, when I was a kid, I had a chance to go on these in Ohio, and it was pretty fun. I think I placed my very first bet I ever made. So since I lost, I have not really been much of a gambler, but it was fun. It was a neat place. Just a question for the Vice President, and thank you for meeting, and it was a great presentation. It looks like a great program and thing that you're trying to do, and I appreciate all the efforts and especially a lot of the give back to the community, and I very much appreciate that. Just have a couple questions. I'm sure you're working a plan, and you got a plan. So what are you looking at for your length for profitability with the horse track?
I'm sorry.
How long are you estimating it'll take before you're profitable, sir?
We're looking at Chairman Atkins, Representative Willis. We think that profitability could be achieved as early as year two, certainly year two, year three. We based upon the response we got, and I'd like to just clarify the one point, we think that we can indeed have a self-sufficient horse operation here with the responses we've gotten from the seven-state area in Canada and the numbers coming in from our racing secretary. We think that a longer season and profitability could be upon us. The cards, yes, it's a contributor, it's an insurance policy. If you look around the country, sir, that seems to be what is going on. But we think that we will have a self-sufficient situation there, and we think that profitability can be achieved in our second year of racing. We think that that's very, very possible. That's certainly what we are shooting for. Obviously, in the first year, we'll be totally supporting the purses because it's a startup business. It's a business that has not had a financial history or the benefit of that the other tracks have had of being around and going through the trials and tribulations. We don't think we'll have those. We think it'll be smooth sailing, and again, we do not believe this is an expansion, sir.
Okay. Representative Willis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and just and thank you for your comments. Just one final answer then. So just, you know, so your business plan, you're kind of working your plan. What are your other, you know, what are you looking at for, like, future for your, you know, your growth of your business, or how do you have a growth plan, or what do you, you know, what are you looking at? You know, I mean, you look at most businesses when they start up or whatever, they've got a, you know, a five-year plan. What are your, you know, what are you doing to, how else will you see revenue, or is the revenue that you're going to see from this be adequate, sir?
Chairman Atkins, Representative Willis. First of all, we expect all components of this operation to be self-sufficient. This is going to be a year-round facility. This is not just a horse racing facility, and we'll have a longer season of time, too. But we think that our food operations, our outside events, we think the community activity that we've gotten indications of already will make each component profitable. Obviously, the gaming side should be. There'll be a simulcast side vis-a-vis this bill that will also bring it. We think that this community needs and wants to have more activity up north. It's been a community in an area of the Twin Cities that's been denied. We almost have the Vikings as a neighbor. That's unfortunate that we don't have them, but we think we're going to fill that gap and fill a void and create some development and ancillary activity that will bring profit to us and to the community and to other industries. We think they'll be self-sufficient.
Representative Willer?
Mr. Chairman, and sir, thank you very much for your comments. I've got a note passed by a fellow member. Apparently, I was doing some illegal gambling, and I'll go to counseling for that, or church, or
we have our future.
We've actually alerted the authorities, Representative Willis. Are there other questions for members of the committee for either the author or any of the witnesses? Seeing none, Chair will renew his motion that House File 2964 be recommended to pass as amended. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Next up is House File 3115. That's my bill, members. I'll turn the gavel over to Representative Willie. Thank you.
Well, hopefully the chairman has brought some sunglasses and beach balls or something to...
Yeah, I apologize. I forgot you're not allowed to testify over here if you don't have your sunglasses on. I will be very brief, members, in view of the fact that that we follow our friends on the Capital Investment Committee. I will just simply move House File 3115, be recommended to pass, and refer to the House floor. And with that, my presentation is very brief. You've heard this bill before. You've heard it in committee. You've heard it on the floor. It has changed a bit, but only to the extent that its original version was House File 1251. I took into account literally every concern that every specific concern that was raised by members of industry, most important of the insurance industry, most important of those was removing direct action, which seemed to be the thing that that set off the most people, and then restricting the application of first party claims. So this is literally only against only involving claims where it's an insured party against their own insurance company, not against somebody else's insurance company. It gets at, you'll remember, tragically, we were joined, I apologize, I still choke up when I think about the Christensens that joined us, that were sitting in the gallery. They lost their daughter in a car accident. They got delayed and denied for months and years before their claim was finally paid, and it was paid. There was no legitimate basis. I've sent you any number of descriptions of similar claims that have arisen. This isn't occurring rampantly, but it occurs often enough and significantly enough that Minnesota needs a law. The final comment that I will make to you is that as we were working towards trying to find a solution for this, working with the members of industry, I remember telling this group that there's 46 states in the country that have a bad faith law. I was wrong. They gave me their book. This is the Insurance Federation's book. And I read their book. There's 49 states that have a law on bad faith. There's some that supplement it with administrative remedies in addition to that. There's 49 states. At this point, I've even told folks from the industry, and I told the governor's office, that if they wanted to take a dart and throw it at a map of the United States, I'd probably accept just about any law in the country just to get at those situations like the Christensen's face with their insurance company. And with that, I'm not going to call a bunch of witnesses or anything like that. You've heard all the arguments. I'd appreciate your support to put it back to the House floor.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. Is there any folks that'd like to be heard? I see on the list here we have a gentleman from the Insurance Federation. You want to come up and please state your name for the record? And on deck is Mr. Marsh.
So. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Mark Holder from the Insurance Federation, but we also have a testifier here. I'm Mr. Dale Thornsgill from the Defense Lawyers Association would like to testify. We actually would like to have him start, if that's okay.
Okay. Go ahead, sir. Please state your name for the record, and go ahead when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dale Thornsgill. I'm an attorney in private practice in the Twin Cities area. I'm a member of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm co-chair of that association's Insurance Law Committee. My practice represents both policyholders and insurance companies. I'm here purely as a private practitioner to give some comments and thoughts on the bill as it is presented, and I'm not here on behalf of any particular client. I am here to oppose House File 3115, and there's really a lot of reasons why this bill in its present form, while I believe it's better than what the bill was that was presented initially a year ago, I think it still falls far short of defining the problem that is being sought to be regulated here, funding the ability to enforce the regulation, and providing positive results from the legislation. First of all, we presently have no first-party bad faith law in Minnesota. That's absolutely correct. The concern with this bill is that this bill is not designed just to address first-party bad faith claims. This will also impact third-party liability claims as well, contrary to what the chair has said to the committee. And that is a concern because the standard that is being presented in this bill, which is something out of the Wisconsin Supreme Court case of Anderson, is a very imprecise standard and doesn't give an ability to get a clear delineation of conduct that is required to be able to abide by the bill and by the standards that are set up in the bill. In essence, it's going to punish all of the carriers that try really hard to comply with handling matters appropriately, and it's only going to be limited by the ability of one set of lawyers to respond to the ingenuity of another set of lawyers. Really what you end up having here is a bill that's going to create a cause of action that will be added to every insurance claim that ever gets litigated, and in fact it will create more litigation involving insurance than what currently exists. What you end up having then is you have the tail wagging the dog of the purported bad faith claim, because that's how people around the country talk about these cases. They don't talk about them as good faith cases, they talk about them as bad faith cases. And so you're going to have the question of bad faith wagging the tail of whether or not there's going to be an insurance claim paid and settled. The bill takes a look at a standard and goes literally from one end of the spectrum and tries to impose a standard that is totally on the opposite end of the spectrum from what we have. It's like taking a sledgehammer to try to kill a fly. There are numerous, numerous other jurisdictions that have more moderate, more appropriate types of standards to apply, whether they be more aggressive administrative remedies, whether they be ancillary remedies and not the cause of action that becomes the center of the lawsuit. And I submit that those additional standards around the country really have not been taken a look at in a well-vetted approach on how to deal with what this bill is going to address. There are higher standards of proof that may be required as well that certainly are utilized in many, many jurisdictions around the country to be able to prohibit a lawyer from trying to threaten a bad faith claim in order to enhance a settlement that would otherwise be perfectly appropriate. And I think that's the greatest concern here, is that this bill creates an industry that hasn't been in Minnesota before, and that is the massive insurance policyholder lawyer who looks and takes cases merely to enhance the recovery beyond what the value is based upon the facts of the case applied to the law in light of the policy language. And that's always been the standard for dealing with insurance, whether it be in this state or other states. But by allowing a bad faith cause of action in the standard that is applied here, it will create that opportunity to get enhanced results that will do nothing more than raise premiums, which will be a private tax on the citizens of the state. It will create an ability or an inability of the court system to regulate, to enforce the regulation, because that's really what this is. This is a regulation of the insurance industry. But you're asking the courts to enforce this without funding the courts to be able to deal with it. The fiscal note that was developed on this bill last year showed that there would be an impact, financial impact, on the judiciary. But the judiciary, as it sits right now, may well get a 3% cut in their budget this year. And if you're dealing with that and then asking them to enforce this regulation, then you haven't funded the entity that you want to be able to deal with the issue. That's like asking the Commerce Department to enforce more administrative remedies without funding them as well. And so, you know, it's a question of what's good for the goose and what's good for the gander sort of thing.
Mr. Thomster, are you... Because we have other specifiers too, so I mean, I don't want to interrupt you, but go.
Well, I'll jump to the last couple of points. I am on the second page, almost halfway through with it.
Okay. I'm sure we'll have a few questions up here as well.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think one of the things that also comes up is that the problem with the bill as it was introduced last year was the direct action. Well, really, it doesn't change that much with this version of the bill. You'll see it towards the end of this bill that it addresses matters involving no-fault arbitration. And really what this bill will do is create double litigation, especially when it comes to matters of no-fault issues. You will get the small claims that go out of the court system under 65B.525, which is the no-fault arbitration provision, but then you're inviting them back into the court to deal with the bad faith cause of action that would be created here. And so you're really creating a vehicle for double litigation, which was really one of the points to try to be avoided. Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments. I thank you for the opportunity, and I look forward to questions that you may have.
Mr. Chair, would you like to do questions now, or do you want to take the rest of the time?
I think we'll save them, but thank you, Mr. Thornstow, and just please stick around and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, again, my name is Mark Kalba. I'm here representing the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. The Insurance Federation represents the property casualty insurers in Minnesota, the majority of them at least, by market share. That includes lines like auto insurance, homeowners insurance, workers' comp, liability policies and commercial liability policies. We do not represent the large health maintenance organizations or the life insurance industry. But on behalf of the majority members of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, we are opposed to House File 3115. And in fact, just this week, we introduced legislation, House File 3426, in the Senate, at Senate File 3116, that actually uses the tools that we already have in current law in the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act and allows the Department of Commerce to have additional administrative enforcement over our industry. If you look in the statutes back there in Chapter 72A.201, you'll see page after page after page a very comprehensive list of claim settlement practices laws that we have to abide by, and it is our opinion that the best forum for consumers is not to engage them in a lengthy, complex litigation system that really doesn't provide them any new benefits under House File 3115, but instead imposes additional costs, not only on them in terms of premiums that they'd have to pay if the insurers have to pay more in settlements or more in legal fees to fight and win in court, but also to the court system. As you heard Mr. Thornfield say, there will be a burden on the court system when more lawsuits flood into the system. And we've seen an example of that, for example, in Washington this year. In November, they imposed, with a referendum, they did allow a bad faith cause of action. And we've already seen the pace of about 1,200 lawsuits per year filed in Washington state already. And so we know that there will be additional lawsuits. What we think is a better solution, then, is to provide consumers with a mechanism to engage the Commerce Department in a way that's easier for them to understand. It'll result in a quicker resolution, and in case where they are allowed to have restitution, there is a provision to compensate them for their time and effort going to the Commerce Department. That bill is it's sponsored in the House by Representative Pawlowski. The Senate sponsor is Senator Scheid. We've had a very positive comments on that bill from both the governor's office and the Department of Commerce and a bipartisan group of lawmakers, and we're looking forward to engaging in the debate on that particular topic as well. In the meantime, we know that we have a coalition of folks who were with us last year in terms of opposition to a bill that imposes a bad faith cause of action. We have one member of the coalition here, Marcus Marsh, who'd like to speak as well. And we did have a meeting just today with the Minnesota Fire, the Minnesota Fire Fire Services Council, we did present to them some information on the progress of the bill this year, and we know that the fire services were opposed to the bill last year, and they committed to us again that they are opposed to the bill this year as well. So with that, I'll let Marsh comment.
Thank you, Mr. Calder. And go ahead, Mr. Marsh, when you're...
Thank you. I'll be very brief. Obviously, this is a very complex area, and I'm not an attorney, so that's why folks like Dale are to try to get into some of the more finite details. But I do want to make a couple real quick comments. First of all, our association is made up of 96 farm mutuals across the state of Minnesota. We insure the majority of farms in Minnesota, and we write in up to second-class cities across the state for homeowners. Our board of directors has taken a position in opposition to this bill. We feel that we already have a bad faith or good faith law, however the terminology wants to be crafted in the Unfair Claims Practices Act 72A. As Dale indicated, this, we feel, and our legal counsel's opinion, would make every claim a potential lawsuit, and we have a great concern with that. All of our companies, except four larger companies that we package either liability or buy reinsurance from, are captive Minnesota. We don't feel the case has been made for this proposed legislation. Mark has talked about the administrative remedy idea. I know that we are listed in the bill as being exempt, but let me just cover a couple of moments why we don't think that does it, and quite frankly, I'm not sure if one group should be picked out or another. I know the health industries come in and ask to be out, and counties and city trusts have asked to be out, and others are probably asking to be out. So I think that's a little testimony that maybe this has got some major impact. But we do one unique thing in Minnesota that I don't think anybody else does, and that is we have a package policy. Our mutuals do not cover liability, so we have to package that with a larger company, even if you exempted us. With a larger company, that would impact us. Plus, in addition to packaging that liability, we buy a disproportionate high amount of reinsurance because our companies are small. And each year you have to negotiate that reinsurance contract. And the fact is, if you start having a higher incident of claims, higher claims, higher legal fees, that impacts that reinsurance contract, we're going to get a substantial increase in that reinsurance contract. So I don't know how, and I'm not a lawyer, but I don't know how you can write a law that just isn't going to impact us. Our legal counsel believes it is, even with the exemption in it. So I just mention that because I don't want to have people think that we are somehow exempt. We're not. And my last comment is, again, sometimes there's unintended consequences. Again, our 96 companies are all across Minnesota being mutuals. The policy owners own the company. We think we probably have the best rates in town. And if anybody that's least likely to be able to withstand constant threats of litigation over claim after claim would be our small company. So you inadvertently, you may actually be helping the largest of the large at the expense of the smaller captive Minnesota company. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Anybody else like to be heard on this issue, either for or against? Seeing none, I don't know if Chair Atkins, do you want to respond at all, or do you want to stand for questions from... Okay, we'll come up here. Wait a sec before you go, guys. Representative Zellers, go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Marsh, it was actually your comment right there towards the end that I want to focus on and make sure that the committee fully grasps that, just like yesterday when we were talking about the... Chamber of Commerce supporting the gas tax tab fee, single largest tax increase in state history bill. The smaller, more locally owned mutual insurance companies, those that would look at, say, a big trial lawyer firm coming in and threatening with a lawsuit, again, would be the most likely or least likely to settle, because they don't have a team of lawyers. Not that we're, again, picking sides here, but just to be clear, because I don't think many members quite got the full grasp of what this will do to our smaller business owners.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zellers, that's what I was trying to say. I think our smaller companies would be much more impacted than others by a threat of a lawsuit, just, again, because we're small. And maybe one other thing I should mention is the major reinsurer that two-thirds of our companies use, two-thirds of our 96 companies use, is called Ram Mutual out of ESCO, which again is a 100% captive Minnesota company. They do not, they're also a direct writer, but they're our major reinsurer of two-thirds of our companies, and they're strictly captive Minnesota. And so I think not only impacting us, but impacting a reinsurer that is a good corporate citizen in the Duluth area, just south of Duluth, and EFCO is very troubling to us.
Representative Zellers,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Marsh. And, you know, as the Chair said, we've been through this many times, and although you may have peeled a few of the layers off the onion, the closer you get to the middle, it still makes your eyes water, and we're going to undo an industry in our state that, unfortunately, we're not federally regulated, so each state can be competitive or uncompetitive, and if 49 other states have done this, I don't think we need to become one of the worst. We've done enough of that this week. Leave the industry alone. I think the Commerce Department is the best place for these things, and I'd renew my opposition to the bill, even scaled back. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson, and then you're on deck, Mr. Representative Paulson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could, Mr. Kolda, I think it was referenced earlier that this would increase insurance rates. What are we talking about? What have we seen in other states that have implemented language like this? What kind of increases are we talking about for the consumers of insurance?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, it's difficult because there's not a very good apples-to-apples comparison when Representative Atkins mentions that 49 other states have a bad faith law. When you actually look at statutes, only a dozen or so have an actual statute. Many other states have imposed this through a judicial decision. So it is not a real easy way to figure out, well, what exactly would this bill mean to premium. What we can do, though, is go the opposite way and show you that there were several states where they had bad faith and they decided to get rid of it, and we saw substantial premium reductions. And two examples are the state of California, which about 15 years ago or so removed bad faith, and the state of West Virginia, which just a few years ago removed bad faith. And in both of those states, premiums were reduced from a range from about 10 to 19%. And we think that's because of the decrease in litigation costs. So it's very difficult to say what would this bill do, but we know what has happened when we've taken bad faith off of the books, and that's the best way we can answer that.
Representative Anderson?
Mr. Kolda, so what do California and the other states that removed it, what do they do now to address concerns for citizens that feel they're not getting service from their insurance provider?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, a good example is West Virginia has imposed the administrative remedy similar to what our bill that we've introduced. Actually, we used West Virginia as an example where their Department of Insurance has the authority, much like ours does, to take action against insurers. And the Department of Commerce here does take action against insurers to keep them, you know, true to the mission of paying claims when they should.
Mm-hmm.
And they do.
Okay.
Representative Anderson?
I promise this is the last question.
Okay.
This is for Mr. Marsh. Do you, I know this is maybe perhaps hard to do, but on other states that do have language similar to this, have you seen a decrease? Is that something that you know as far as the mutual providers? Is that something you can maybe get to me later on? Or is that something you just don't have
Mr.
to view at
this point? And Representative Anderson, I don't know that I'm able to answer your question precisely, because when they talk about premiums going up, some cases it's auto, some cases it's property casualty. And I don't know how it broke out, but our concern is that there has been a history where premiums have went up dramatically because of increased litigation or threat of litigation.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Paulson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Atkins, I'm just curious, the reference was made to the other bill that's coming forward. I'm just wondering if, you know, we got two ships passing in the night here, if is that something you're going to be looking to working with? It was referenced as well. So we do get a solution to this issue, and I know it's—I mean, I know you're passionate on your side of the issue here, but to make progress, and you know, with the governor's support and with the legislature's support on a bipartisan basis, I'm just curious if that's going to be the intention to hear this bill too, or kind of what the plan is.
Chair Atkins,
Chair Representative Paulson, I've been doing my darndest to try to find a common ground. I can show you 33 letters I sent to Mr. Johnson of the Insurance Federation asking for language that they promised me back at the end of last session. The bill that has been introduced weakens Minnesota law, so I don't support it. I don't intend to hear it. Other than that shortcoming, I think it's fine.
Representative Paulson?
Just keep an open line, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Seeing none, you want a final word or anything, Chair Atkins? Or,
just a brief response. Maybe I can, if it's all right with you, Mr. Chair, I'll just say it from here. Just a couple of clarifying things. First off, the West Virginia, California reference, they impacted third-party claims. This bill addresses first-party claims. It was noted that it's not a very high standard or something like that. This is actually among the highest standards in the country. I wanted a lower standard, but I've been doing my best to try to work with the other side. I think it is either the highest or very close to the highest. And what it says is that the insurer literally has to know of the lack of a reasonable basis for denying the benefits of the insurance policy. They literally got to know it. It's not reckless disregard or negligence or anything like that. It's an exceptionally high standard. And the final point is, in terms of what leads to litigation in Minnesota, is the same thing that leads to it anywhere else, which is unreasonable delays and denials. That's what leads people to sue. The purpose of this bill is to prevent that, so it should lead to less litigation, not more. And with that, I'd appreciate your support.
With that, Chair Atkins renews his motion at House File 3115 is recommended to pass and sent to the House floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
bill passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Off to the floor. That's it for today. See you next Thursday. The chair will be gone, so as they say, when the cat's away, the mice can play, so you guys can we can have
Chairman,
some fun.
I've got several bills I'd like to add to the agenda then.
I'm open to that.
We're adjourned.